Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Neil Quigley. I'm Deputy Vice Chancellor of Victoria. My pleasure to welcome all of you here this evening to the Reserve Bank Professorial Fellowship in Monetary and Financial Economics public lecture by Professor Charles Goodhart. We have endeavoured to start right on time because towards the end of the lecture there is a danger that we'll start competing with the noise from a concert which is happening just down the road. Some of you will have noticed the traffic going in that direction. I'm just looking around to make sure there's no one here who came in here thinking this would be AC/DC concert. And if we finish promptly, hopefully those of you who are planning to attend will be able to get to that event tonight as well. It's great to have you here, and also an honour for me to thank once again the Reserve Bank for their support of the fellowship and the public lecture series. The program has now been going for a decade, and in the course of that period, we've had the honour to host many very fine economists to come to share their insights with us. So it's my pleasure to hand over to Dr. Alan Bollard to introduce our speaker. Alan.
Well, thank you very much. I'll be brief. Yes, we're on behalf of the Reserve Bank, we've hosted jointly a number of very influential people in the New Zealand system. And the great thing about the New Zealand system is that you can make a difference. And we're very pleased to welcome back Charles Goodhart, who has been quite instrumental in coming to New Zealand at key times in the past and having a very big influence. He did that around the setting up of the and design of the Reserve Bank Act, and he's been back since then on a number of occasions as well. At the same time, he's continued to have a very interesting set of interests across areas that aren't easily bridged by traditional economists on the one hand or financial people on the other hand. And that's been an area that really come into focus with the whole period of financial instability and its big effect on the macro economy generally. So there's not very many eminent academics and practitioners around the world who are able to talk authoritatively and be at the cutting edge of work going on how the financial instability and macro financial policy impacts back on the macro economy and vice versa. And so we couldn't really ask for anybody better, more informative, and more focused on the sort of issues that we and all our trading partners are basically facing at the minute. That's enough from me. You've had Charles' very interesting background in the letter of invitation, and we won't take any questions on sheep farming, but anything else will be there for you. This lecture is being recorded by Radio New Zealand, so please bear that in mind later on if anybody wants to ask questions that doesn't want them to be recorded, then we'll gag them. But now it's my pleasure to hand over to Professor Goodhart. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Adam. Actually, I'd be very happy to take questions on sheep farming, but I expect to learn more from you than I can possibly tell you. I think the one surprise for me this evening is I'm the only person who seems to have brought an umbrella. So, having been in Wellington before, I always reckon that the likelihood of getting rained upon is quite high, but I suppose you all reckon that the winds are sufficiently strong that you can't actually use it without it inside out. However, that's not really what we're here to talk about. What I really want to talk about is what is the regulatory response to the crisis that we have had. And in particular, one of the set of buzzwords nowadays is the need to move on from micro-prudential supervision, which is really the way in which the authorities look after the individual institutions, to much more concerned with macro-prudential supervision, and that is trying to see how robust and resilient the system as a whole was or might be. And these are very different. You cast your mind back to mid-2007, at that stage, The capital ratios and the profitability of banks admitted in all our countries was about at an all-time high. It was thought that the conditions of the individual banks were so strong that a relatively minor shock to a small section of the mortgage market, admittedly the biggest country in the world, shouldn't be capable of having the effects that it turned out to have. And one of the reasons that it turned out to have such a large effect was that the system as a whole was subject to severe pressures, interactive pressures, as a result of the fact that everybody was overextended with leverage, with the effect that when things started to go wrong, that led to individual banks having to lighten their positions and sell assets. That lowered asset prices, that worsened the position for everybody else, and effectively you've got a self-amplifying spiral. So one of the things that we have learned in the course of this crisis is that the achievement of price stability doesn't guarantee financial stability. Until the crisis struck on, and you can almost give it a specific date, August 9th, 2007, the central banks have been remarkably successful over the previous 15 or so years in maintaining price stability, in maintaining inflation at low and stable rates, without having much volatility in output. And indeed, in my own country, every quarter since the end of 1992 until effectively 2008, it had been positive. There had been no single quarter downturn. Not only is it now clear that maintenance of price stability does not guarantee financial stability, but you can even argue that they run counter to each other. And the reason why they run counter to each other was effectively explained by an underappreciated American economist called Chaim Lindsay, who in many ways produced some of the most insightful writing on financial cycles in recent years. And he argued that stability generates instability, by which effectively what he meant was that if you have a very stable period, and particularly if you think that the authorities can maintain that stability indefinitely, it then becomes your view that risk is reduced. And there was a generalized view throughout almost the whole of the developed world that risk had been contained. In part, there was this expectation that the central bankers had become so good that they were able to counter any significant crack or collapse in financial markets. What was known as the Greenspan put, which effectively meant that if markets collapsed, the authorities could and would lower interest rates sufficiently quickly and sufficiently far to restore the situation and bring about recovery in asset markets. And this had become credible, because after all, it effectively had worked. It worked on Black Monday, and I think it was October the 17th, 1987. It worked again in the Southeast Asian crisis of 97-98. It worked over the LTCM crisis, and it worked again at the time of the NASDAQ bubble and bust in 2000-2001. In each case, Greenspan and the Fed lowered interest rates sufficiently strongly in order to bring about a restoration recovery pretty quickly. And the developed world never really suffered severe crises during these times. So there was a belief that Alan Greenspan in particular, and central bankers as a generality, were almost walking on water. They had the ability now to make the system safe. And if the system is safe, particularly when interest rates are low, and particularly when you are promised that interest rates will remain low for an extended period of time, is more or less an incentive, a signal to commercial bankers, financiers around the world, effectively to go out and put on leverage. And anyone who didn't put on massive leverage was regarded as a win. And what were you doing? Not trying to not making profits, taking on a sufficient risk to maintain your profits, let alone your bonuses, at this time when risk had been removed from the situation. And as Heinitzky effectively said, as people believe that risk has been removed from the system, effectively they expand their position, take on much more and more leverage, to a point where a relatively small shock can effectively knock over the whole house of cards. And that effectively was what happened. Now, one of the implications and results of that has been that a number of people have argued that the inflation target regime, which you initiated back in 1988-89, was flawed because it concentrated too much on price stability and didn't, or goods and services price stability, and didn't take enough account of asset price stability. Now, I myself don't think that that actually is right, because the attempt to achieve both these targets with a single instrument, which is of course the official interest rate, would cause a variety of problems. Let me take one particular problem at the moment. Just now, there's a great deal of uncertainty about where the world is going. Half the people I talk to are frightened that there may be massive great inflation, huge increase in liquidity that's being injected into the world system, at the world central banks over the last 9 months to 12 months. The reserve base of the commercial banking system is being expanded explosively. Asset prices have been recovering. There is a tendency for deterring the Americans to watch the State of the Nation speech this afternoon, as I did a bit from President Obama. It's very clear that for political reasons, the Americans are going to go on expanding pretty rapidly for quite a time. And that's potentially inflation. At the same time, we have a huge increase in spare capacity, massive rate unemployment. Although asset prices have increased, the monetary aggregates are still very sluggish. Bank lending is going down in most countries. So there are a whole other group of people who are terrified about deflation. In fact, some of the people I talk to are terrified about both hands. usually deflation followed by inflation. And under these circumstances, where people are very frightened about the possibility of our economic system and our price developments getting out of hand, what you need to be able to do is to reassure people that the authorities are not going to allow either inflation or deflation to take those from them. And that, in my view, means that it becomes actually more than ever necessary to hold on to the straight inflation target and to dedicate effectively the official interest rate for that particular objective. Now, and also there's the point which was being made by Alan Greenspan and others, but I think it's correct, which is that if you do get an asset price bubble and there's a lot of optimism about developments in a particular asset sector, whether it be housing, commodity prices, or anything else, it usually takes an interest rate increase that, if it is sufficient to deal with the asset price bubble, would probably knock the economy on its head. And it is extraordinarily difficult for a central banker consciously to raise interest rates sufficiently to actually drive the economy into recession, purely in order to deal with an asset price development which you are never absolutely sure is unsustainable, and you cannot be sure is a bubble. And indeed, there is no decent definition of the word bubble, or the only definition of the word bubble that actually holds water, requires conditions which have never, ever effectively been seen in modern markets. So if you want to leave the inflation target more or less untouched, as I do, then what you need to do, recognizing that the authorities in general, the central bank in particular, has also got responsibility for financial stability, is to collect, provide a set of further instruments to achieve the second target. And it is this second set of instruments that should provide the basis for what is known as macroprudential regulation. We don't have these instruments yet, and I don't really be talking about them now. Now, the discussions on such a second set of instruments have actually differed rather between Europe and the USA as I travel between the two, though I'm exaggerating this differentiation between the European approach and the American approach somewhat for reasons of trying to make a point. Essentially, what has happened is that the Europeans have focused and concentrated on trying to generate and develop counter-cyclical regulations which should be adjusted by the relevant authorities. In other words, what they are looking for is greater powers to the regulatory authorities, and in particular the central banks, to try and control the banking developments in a way that will prevent these crises recurring, or at least recurring in the same way in the future. The Americans have tended very much more towards a different market-based insurance mechanism. And here there is, I think, a difference in underlying philosophy. The Americans have seen that, in a sense, the paradigm of the relationship between the authorities and the banks has been somewhat changing. In the past, the paradigm, particularly of the relationship between the central bank and the banks, has been the old Bagot principle, Walter Bagot, Lombard Street, whereby the authorities should provide liquidity support to banks which are illiquid, but not insolvent. The ones that are insolvent should be let go. Now, clearly, insolvency is a severe problem, as we've seen when Lehman was let go. So the Europeans are trying to establish regulations to try and prevent the banks and other systemic financial institutions reaching towards an insolvent condition. Now, the Americans see the situation as changing, in the sense that following Lehman's, there is a view that no set of authorities in any major country is, for the foreseeable future, actually ever going to allow any of its systemic major institutions to close, to be liquidated. Whatever happens to the shareholders and the managers, the big systemic institutions will from now on be supported. In other words, what you can say is that the authorities are moved from the banking principle to the insurance principle, in which effectively the authorities are now actually insuring both the solvency and the liquidity of all the major systemic institutions. And that means that instead of worrying too much about the regulation, which in any case the Americans have a tendency to believe, that government officials, including central bankers, are always relatively incompetent at setting prices, and that the banks will always run rings around them. And the regulation is always a relatively ineffective and inefficient mechanism. So the Americans are looking for mechanisms to try and use market mechanisms as far as possible to encourage systemic financial institutions and banks in particular to, if possible, self-insure, and where self-insurance is not possible, to try and price the insurance mechanism in such a way that it, at any rate, accords reasonably closely with market mechanisms. In contrast, the Europeans have much less faith in market mechanisms, and the Europeans do not share the general American view that regulation is always a losing game, because, to use an American phrase, regulation is static by which I mean that it takes a long time to introduce regulation, and when it is there, it remains in place for a long time, whereas markets are dynamic, which means that when the regulation comes out, the clever people working at the banks will have already worked out ways to get around it, and the loopholes will become bigger and bigger and bigger if the loopholes, even at the outset, are not so big that the regulation effectively is ineffective. Now, what are the instruments? Now, the European-style countercyclical mechanisms that have been suggested are, first of all, that the very process of trying to introduce systemic regulation and systemic supervision will be introduced, the European Systemic Risk Board, and will help by itself. Now, the European Systemic Risk Board, which has just been set within the Eurozone, actually has no powers, because the powers to undertake regulation and supervision remain with the nation state. However, the European Systemic Risk Board, which will be largely dominated and run and managed by the ECB, will examine all potential systemic risks, and when they see a systemic risk developing, they have the right to go to the relevant national authorities and ask the national authorities to do something about it, and to require the national authorities to report back within a space of time what they have done. And the very exercise of being told to do something by the ESRB, having to report back will help by itself. Now, in addition to that, the kind of mechanisms that are under control are capital requirements, which will be raised, particularly on the riskier prop desk and market-related and shadow banking system aspects of this, and maybe time there, in the sense that you raise capital requirements during booms and lower them during busts. And this may or may not include the Spanish-type dynamic pre-provision, which in effect meant that when lending was going ahead very rapidly during a credit boom, the banks were required to provision on a generalized expectation that whenever lending was growing very rapidly, there'd be a lot of bad debts developing. Think what's going to happen in China in terms of the increase in their non-performing loans within a year or two. And when you get bank lending growing at 30% per annum, the number of bad loans that you can expect are quite large. And then when bank lending declines, you can release the provisions because they then become useful. One of the problems here is that the Spanish dynamic pre-provisioning exercise runs entirely counter all the instincts of an accountant. Because an accountant doesn't like measuring anything that he cannot touch or see. And the accountants are rather like Dagny Thomas, show me your wounds. And the idea that you can estimate the future likelihood of being wounded by non-performing loans simply as a function of the fact that credit is growing far too fast, something that is completely averse to every instinct of an accountant. But maybe policymakers and economists can overcome the accountant's concerns. And then there are time and state varying liquidity requirements, which may well include not only liquidity requirements in terms of requiring differing asset ratios, but may also require time and state varying requirements on the ratio of core funding to loans. And then, in addition, other margining in other markets, particularly in the housing market, with the possibility of introducing time and state varying housing requirements. So as housing prices rise relative to the norm and the speed, both the speed of rise of housing and property prices and the level relative to the norm, you would lower the loan to value ratio that you could introduce. Now, there are a number of more fundamental suggestions which are unlikely to occur,
For example, a lot of the problems that have arose have occurred because of the advantages and subsidies on debt finance, fixed interest finance, rather than equity finance. So there have been various proposals to try and remove or reduce the tax allowance on interest rates. So that's not likely to get anywhere, because it would have to be introduced internationally to be effective. And then to maybe to restrict limited liability in some ways. In particular, there was rather a nice idea that was floated in the pages of the Financial Times, that bankers, maybe other financiers, should find that their accumulated bonuses during the period in which they'd been with a particular bank and for N years after they left that bank would be subject to unlimited liability, net, of course, of the tax that they were already paid. So let's say that a particular bank chief had developed, shall we say, $10 million worth of bonuses, a relatively small amount these days, some of our banks in the year, and the bank then ran into difficulties, that $10 million net of any tax that he or she had already paid would be subject to complete and full clawback. So there are a number of ideas along those lines. Now, what are the kind of problems with these measures? First of all, how do you measure and apply them? How do you make them countercyclical? What is systemic? What is a systemic institution? Again, the government's proposals and Barney Frank's proposals in that House bill are actually quite in line with most of the European proposals. And they talk confidently about a set of systemic financial intermediaries. But what is systemic isn't fixed. It varies according to the conjuncture. And when people are frightened, a lot of very small institutions can be systemic. When there's a lot of confidence and markets are going up, you can absorb the loss of quite a large financial intermediary without necessarily having any contagion at all. So what is systemic is not a fixed feature. It varies. Again, the whole of this area is made vastly more difficult by the fact that any institution which is systemic is almost always, almost by definition, the same kind of cross-border. Of the 19 banks that were subject to the stress test in the US, I haven't actually checked them out, but I would reckon that all bar one or two at most had a significant part of their operations in other countries as well as the United States. And it's certainly true of every European country I know that all the systemic institutions, not only banks but insurance companies, the lot, have major cross-border subsidiaries and also branches. Now, this raises huge difficulties because it means that, first of all, you've got to have international agreements on all your regulatory measures, and beyond that, the legal basis of dealing with a bank getting into difficulty differ from country to country. The bankruptcy laws are enormously different from one country to another. The whole mechanisms of insolvency differ. And that means that dealing with the resolution of a failing bank and all your systemic institutions are going to be cross-border. So any systemic institution that fails, you're going to have to deal with the cross-border problems. And we have got no good way of doing that at the moment. It is a huge gap. Let me move down. The whole basis of this counter-cyclical approach runs contrary to market forces. And inevitably so. That's the purpose of regulation. And what you are doing as a regulator is that when the market gets overly optimistic, and when asset prices are going up, when bank profitability seems to be jumping ahead, when everyone is feeling terribly confident, overconfident, what you are doing is, in McChesney Martin's phrase, is you are trying to take away the punch bowl just when the party gets going. And for those of you with teenage children, the idea of taking away the punch bowl when your teenage children's party is getting going, you are not the most popular person in the world. You are not popular with the politicians. You remind member subprime. Subprime, although it is now demonized, and I think almost unduly demonized, during its glory years, 2004-2006, was the apple of the eye of the American politicians. Part of the reason why the whole thing went screwy was because the American politicians actually pressurized the GSEs, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, to extend their ability to introduce guarantees to cover this wider range of subprime and alt-A as well. So the politicians are against you. Inevitably, during the upturn and the boom, the financial intermediaries who are making a mint will be against you, and so, of course, will the borrowers. And the people who were borrowing on subprime thought they were getting their foot on the housing ladder. So had Alan Greenspan actually wanted to do it, trying to intervene against the run of the market to tone down the subprime exercise would have been extraordinarily difficult, quite extraordinarily difficult. One of the great battles between regulators and academics is that regulators, particularly central bankers, tend to argue that conditions are always changing, and that if you introduce a rule whereby you are required to make countercyclical variations in regulation, that the rule will never fit the particular events that happen to be developing. So the central bankers say, trust me, let me have discretion, I'll deal with it. And the academics actually say in return, there were a few central bankers out there, Paul Volcker, and of course Alan, and others, who would take a sufficiently strong stand under these circumstances, and are brave enough to brave the wrath of the politicians, the media, the major banks, the borrowers and all that, and would really be prepared to stand up against the market and say, the hell with it, I can't prove it, I think that this is wrong, and I'm going to try and stop it. But the number of central bankers who actually are prepared to do that, in reality, are quite few. And inevitably say, I'm making yourself a nuisance, more than a nuisance. Stopping what the market wants to do under these circumstances is extraordinarily difficult. So what the academics want to do is to introduce rules that actually require the central banks to have to take steps when bank lending, possibly to the in aggregate or maybe just to individual sectors, starts growing too fast, particularly when prices in these sectors start rising too fast. Now, again, we understand that there can be occasions when the rules look self-evidently silly. And so that most of us academics would actually suggest that what you want to have is a rule, but you either comply with it or you explain why you do not comply with it. And explain or comply on the basis of a rule is, I think, an exceedingly good approach. Another of the arguments against countercyclical regulations is the question which largely comes from the commercial private sector, which is that you say that you will raise the regulation during booms, but can you reduce them in busts? Well, you can. It looks a bit odd. Just when banks are getting fragile, you say, well, we're going to put down the capital requirement. We're going to put down the liquidity requirement. And then the argument comes, well, you may do that as a regulator, but the market isn't going to accept it. The market, when you get a crisis and panic, the market actually then goes into reverse and favors institutions which have higher capital and liquidity requirements. So the constraint doesn't become the regulator, it becomes the market. Under those circumstances, the bankers argue that what appears to be a kind of cyclical regulation will just be higher regulation, more regulation throughout. And if it is more regulation throughout, and that is where we're getting to, will it restrict the size of the controlled banking system too much? There's always a border problem. You control
and regulate one set, banks, systemic financial intermediaries, and you let the rest, the market, smaller, non-bank financial intermediaries, live in a much easier system. Inevitably, under those circumstances, business will shift from the regulated across the border into the unregulated. You haven't, under those circumstances, necessarily reduced risk. You've simply shifted it from one sector to another. And what is more, you may have handicapped your most efficient, most effective part of the financial system, and indeed the only part of the financial system at the moment, which is capable of dealing with the financial requirements of persons, particularly through mortgages, and small and medium enterprises. The large corporates, of course, can go to the market, but they're not as affected by this. And then there's finally the argument, which I mentioned before, about whether the regulators can effectively do this, or whether the financial intermediaries will all run rings around the regulators. And in particular, a final point on here, which is that the international regulations done by the Basel Committee and Banking Supervision have always had one major fate. And that is the Basel Committee, never been set up by treaty, has no legal basis whatsoever. Under those circumstances, the Basel Committee feel that they cannot talk about sanctions and penalties, because that is a matter for the individual nations and its legal system. And they don't have, in their view, the locus to concern themselves with penalties and sanctions. Now, the problem with that is that when the Basel Committee says that what we want is 4% tier 1 or 8% tier 2 or a liquidity ratio or whatever it is, this then becomes in effect a minimum. And if it is a minimum, it provides no flexibility and no buffering at all. If you are required to hold at all times 8% of either liquidity or capital or whatever, then that capital and liquidity is in effect totally and utterly sterilized. It becomes useless. The buffer that all the banks had was not the 8% tier 2 capital requirement, it was the margin above that. And that margin was actually very small indeed. What is needed is a totally different approach, whereby the international regulators actually get over their self-imposed denial of actually talking about sanctions and penalties, and have a consciously determined ladder of sanctions and penalties along the route that the FDIC Improvement Act of 1991 actually introduced, so that I start with a much higher, well-capitalized or strong liquidity bank. And as the bank actually lowers, which you allow it to do, it then runs into increasing penalties of the kind that you cannot provide dividend, or you're not allowed to have remuneration or bonuses greater than a certain percent. And you can think of the kind of sanctions, which in fact the Americans under the FDIC Improvement Act actually already did. Now let me turn quite rapidly to the American style insurance mechanism. Here, one of the approaches is by Atterier and Richardson, in a book called Restoring Financial Stability, is there should be pre-funded levies on riskier portfolios. In some sense, the Obama tax, which was announced, I think it was last week, goes along that route. It didn't hit all the bases, in part because it was ex post rather than ex ante, in part because the riskiness of wholesale funding, which was meant to is related not just to the fact it doesn't come from core retail deposits, but it is related to the maturity of that wholesale funding. Wholesale funding, which is say for 2 years duration, is relatively safe. A bank which doesn't actually have to repay borrowing from the wholesale markets for 2 years is in a fairly strong liquidity position.
But the problem that we faced was that the major banks, particularly the investment houses, were borrowing on the wholesale markets effectively overnight and rolling over the wholesale funding at an extraordinary rate, which meant that if ever there was a loss of confidence, the thing became self-reinforcing, and the banks were forced very quickly to close. So that one of the areas here should have been that the levy should not have been just on wholesale funding, but on wholesale funding interacted with the maturity of that funding. Then again, there is the proposals being suggested by economists, the Squam Lake Group, Mark Flannery and others, for contingent capital, what are now known as COCOs, or conditional convertibles. And this kind of insurance mechanism is one whereby the banks are either encouraged or required to issue debt, a function of which is that under crisis conditions, that debt automatically transforms into equity. We'll talk about the conditions under which it transforms fairly soon. Then again, there are a whole series of other suggestions. The FDIC Improvement Act, which I've already talked about, tried to do prompt corrective action on the basis of capital. There are suggestions by Hart and Zingales that effectively what you do is you watch banks' credit default swap risk premia, and when this rises too high, you either close the bank or you require it to raise more capital. Some of these ideas are rather nutty, and the Hart-Zingales idea is, I think, among the group that are nutty. Now, the reason for that is that the CDS spreads tend to rise just at the moment when the market is very weak. It then becomes extremely difficult for a bank under these pressures to raise new capital. Moreover, the very sight of a bank being forced by increases in CDS swap to have to go and raise money in the market, new equity in the market, under very unfavorable conditions, would immediately, effectively, lead to an increase in the CDS rates of virtually every other bank in the system. And if you can imagine every bank in a major economy being forced to go to a reluctant market simultaneously, it's actually a recipe for total disaster. And there are a whole other series of measures to try and prevent too big to fail, including various proposals for limiting the size of the bank. And we have a very unclear example of that in the measures that were announced by Obama earlier this week, or was it late last week? I can't remember. And there are a whole series of others. There's a splendid exercise by an economist called Ricardo Caballero, which was presented at the Jackson Hole Conference this August, where I was also present, who suggested that banks should be required to take out what he called tradable insurance contracts, so that depending on the asset that the bank held, the bank should actually be required to purchase insurance contracts, which the central bank could intervene in the markets for those to change their price. One of the problems of this was that clearly the amount of insurance depended on the riskiness of the asset. And the central bank was actually required under that scheme to suggest the relativity between the riskiness of different assets, which effectively made the central bank into the credit rating agency for the economy as a whole. Now, no central bank actually would want to be transformed into the situation of trying to assess the relative riskiness and credit arrangement, credit rating of the different banks. Now, a number of the problems of the American proposals, first of all, most of these insurance contracts depend on various triggers. A trigger that a crisis has occurred. Who pulls the trigger? And can you imagine the governor and the chairman of the Fed standing up before the television cameras and actually saying, "Now I declare there is a crisis." And you can imagine what would happen to the markets the day after. And more or less occurred when effectively President George Bush stood up before the cameras and said, "We're now facing a crisis." So given the likely market reaction to pulling the trigger that there is now a crisis, it will probably either never be pulled or be pulled far too late, then most of these insurance products effectively require the asset you hold to become much less valuable under really bad conditions. In other words, these convertible conditional COCOs, the conditional convertible bonds, transform into equity just when the bank is doing disastrously and needs a lot more equity. That effectively means that you lose a massive amount of money on your COCOs just at the very moment when all your other assets are going south at the same time. It's a kind of catastrophe bond which hits you in the face just when the rest of your portfolio is getting into catastrophe at the same time. Now, anyone who's got any sense in terms of portfolio management will realize that this is the kind of asset that no fund manager in their right mind could ever actually want to hold, particularly not another financial intermediary, because CDS were a form of insurance. That's what CDS was. And when the CDS were effectively held in large, in excessive volumes by AIG, it effectively meant that the crisis went from Lehman to AIG, and you had to have a problem. So that any sensible regulator would ensure that the COCOs are not held by leveraged financial intermediaries. That means that effectively their buyer base is going to be fairly limited. Under these circumstances, what is the price and the cost for the banks of issuing these kinds of instruments, of actually trying to get this kind of insurance? Again, this insurance only kicks in when things are really going bad. So will it have the effect of stopping the initial bubble, which has partly been the cause of all the problems? And will it prove time consistent in the sense that when things have just been going very badly, everybody, and we've had a crisis recently, everybody is aware that the insurance payout could be very expensive. So what you do, and what is happening now, is you put a huge charge in your banking system, just when it is weak, just when it is already risk averse, just when it is already putting in the walls. So you are making your banking system, under these circumstances, actually into a position where its practices will cause the recovery to be delayed and put back even further. But as you time passes and the financial crisis goes into distant memory and nothing has happened, people will say, well, why do we have to pay all these heavy levies, and we're safe, like after all, nothing has happened for 50 years. So that in the run-up to 2007, the FDIC was actually reducing the levies that it was imposing on the American banking system, because they reckoned they didn't need it. So that what you will find with this kind of insurance system is that the levies are much too heavy in the immediate aftermath of the crisis, and much too light, just when everyone is becoming too confident. So there are plenty of problems with these as well. So, what's going to happen? Well, we obviously don't know. The European and US proposals are not mutually exclusive and overlap. Indeed, the first COCOs were introduced in the UK rather than the US. What the balance will be between them, nobody knows. A number of complaints about the procedure of trying to introduce better regulation has been that the authorities have lost momentum. I don't think that that's true in the very slightest, and indeed the fact that the Americans have taken really quite dramatic steps to increase or introduce new measures of regulation in the last 2 weeks, I think indicates in this argument that you mustn't waste a good crisis, and we ought actually to start regulating and introduce much tougher regulations much earlier, is without really any foundation. Yet I would argue rather the reverse, that if anything, there is a tendency to try and regulate too far. Indeed, one could argue that for the next 5 or 10 years, the regulators and supervisors can all go home. And the banks are now sufficiently risk averse, aware of the problems, aware of how horrible the effects were of them, that they're going to behave themselves for the next 5 years or so, and without any regulation at all. It's really after about 20 to 25 years, when memories dim and things have become better again, that you need your regulation, just at the point in time when the private sector and everybody else will say it's not necessary. Indeed, I think that there is really quite a severe likelihood that the extent of regulation on our banking systems will be sufficiently tough that it will actually mean that the recovery from the current crisis and recession is going to be elongated and extended to a far greater extent than is necessarily desirable. But we will see. And that brings me 6 minutes beyond the time when I was told that AC/DC was going to start. But I'm glad to say that I haven't heard any music impinging. So if there is some time and any questions that anyone wants to ask.
Well, thank you very much.